Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:20 p.m. that is Central Time. Today is October 28th. I thought we'd kick off with Australia because the two-year yield doubled. In fact, it did more than that, and that's a pretty significant move, and it suggests that Australia is abandoning its, or at least the market expects Australia to abandon its yield control procedure. So we've seen yields contract significantly, going from 2% to almost zero in the course of the last few years. And now we're starting to see those yields come back up again. And Australia is a little bit different from lots of other developed markets because it's got a very strong balance of trade. And that really took off during the pandemic. And I think this is a particularly relevant chart that it ran all the way back to the peaks that we saw in 2008. And now it's starting to come back down. So there's this big question that's sitting out there, and it's how likely is it that inflation is going to continue higher? And I think it's a nuanced question. There's no one answer that's going to be satisfactory, because we're definitely seeing that some of the commodity prices are starting to come back down, most particularly natural gas and coal. And that also helps to highlight the very reason why they went up in the first place, which was politically driven rather than any particular supply inelasticity. It's not like the world is suddenly running out of coal or natural gas for that matter, but rather instead that political motivations have resulted in these extraordinary bottlenecks. So that contributed to a really quite profound increase in Australia's terms of trade, and also contributed to some inflationary pressures domestically. But the bigger pressure from inflation is going to be from wages. That's not going to be driven by commodity prices. And then we can also, I think, pay attention to the fact that some agricultural prices are starting to pick up again. So, for example, oats prices. There's been a big bull market in oat milk, and that's helped to support the oats price, and it has really taken off over the course of the last month. And soybean prices are beginning to steady. They'd had a rather significant correction and came back to the 1200 level, and that's the upper side of the base formation, and we're starting to begin to see at least some evidence of support coming through. And corn prices have also begun to steady, and we're in positive territory over the balance of this week. Wheat prices are coming back up to the upper side of their range and potentially going to break on the upside. It's, I think, also worth highlighting that upward breaks haven't been sustained over the course of the last year, even though there's been a clear upward bias. So there is still likely to be some inflationary pressures that come to bear in terms of food and other commodities, but anything related to China is starting to come back down. So then also, because Russia said that they're going to send more gas through to Europe, well, that's starting to bring down natural gas prices there. The kinds of companies that did best on the back of this supply and elasticity for European gas, like Equinor, well, they did very well, and now we've got the first evidence of resistance starting to come through, so it would suggest that this move is over for at least the next while. Now, when we start to think about China, well, Caixa is on the cusp of failing again. This isn't the first time that they've defaulted on debt. They were recapitalized in 2015 and then relisted in 2017, and now the price is even lower than it was in 2015. So this is contributing to significant upward pressure on emerging market, it's Asian emerging market high yield debt. And there is a chart for that. So it's an AOS price option adjusted spreads, but at least we get a clear vision of just how high the yields are. And they're firming again from around the 10% level. So this is obviously signaling additional risk. And China is in the process of beginning to try and I think they're perhaps the most accurate way of describing it is that they are attempting at least to do some forensic accounting. So there have been efforts underway to try and figure out exactly how large the off-balance sheet liabilities are in China. And we've seen that there have been some bond issues, particularly in cities like Beijing, where they've issued debt to buy back and refinance some of their off-balance sheet liabilities. So that's likely to persist. So they're going to first figure out how big is the debt, because there are lots of bonds out there that have got an implicit government guarantee because they've been issued by local governments, but the central government doesn't actually know how much of them there are. So there's going to be a full accounting of just how large the debt issue is. And then, of course, there is also efforts underway to try and figure out just how large the debts are held by the are issued by the various property developers. Then there is also this question about land sales, and then some of the property developers have stopped land sales, so then they can continue to sell properties. It might kill off their pipeline in the short term, but it might ensure survival. Others are still buying land, and then they are obviously on the hook to try and sell their properties forward. And of course, that is exposing them to even greater risk if property prices continue lower. So we're still in a very flux-driven market with regard to China and the Chinese property sector. So it's certainly something that we need to continue to pay attention to because it has the potential to have a significant knock-on effect for commodity demand. And the CSI 300 was in negative territory again today, but perhaps more importantly now, the LME Metals Index has also started to pull back. So this is looking like a failed upside break. And some of the commodities that are more energy focused, like aluminium, have also been pulling back. The iron ore future in Singapore has started to unwind the recent bounce. So it's looking increasingly likely that this extraordinary upward pressure that we saw in 2020 is, well, it's been fully unwound in the case of iron ore. But this question about property and infrastructure development in China, this isn't about to simply disappear. And it suggests that what happens in the happens in China is obviously going to have a knock-on effect for lots of different commodities. And then the big question is how much of an effect will it have on copper? Because copper does have additional new sources of demand. So the lack of infrastructure development growth in China could sap some of the demand. But then the determination to come up with plans to decarbonize the global economy could create additional demand growth, significant additional demand growth for copper, and at least from the recharging and battery and wind sectors. So that's a good reason why copper prices have been somewhat firmer. But of course, then the big question is about inflation, or perhaps more importantly, stagflation. US growth, there was initial fears this morning that it might have been negative, but it came in around 2% for the last quarter, which was year over year. So That also is a reflection of the fact that the economy hasn't grown a lot following the big rebound off the lows in March of last year through to the beginning of the third quarter in 2020. And if inflationary pressures are still going to be rising in the high single digits, well then that's obviously a creating a risk of stagflation. But I think it's particularly relevant to then just pay attention to what's actually going on in other government bonds. So 10-year yields were softer for four consecutive days and a little bit steadier in here today. And the dollar index has been pulling back. So Japan today said that they're still worried about deflation and they're not going to be abandoning their yield control policy anytime soon. The yen was a little stronger today because it's been quite weak over the last 3 weeks. The dollar continues to pull back, and a good part of the reason for that is because Christine Lagarde was lukewarm in her defense of the ECB policy to hold down rates. And a good part of the reason for that is because inflation in Germany is running at over 5%. So obviously that is going to pressure the ECB. And how willing are they going to be to run inflationary pressures? And this is an awfully big question for Europe because the only formal mandate that the ECB has is to control inflation. So they're pretty much duty bound to do something about it if it persists. And this I think assumption that inflation is going to be transitory is starting to wear thin, particularly from the perspective of wage demand growth. And it is this wage demand growth is where the argument for less than transitory inflation is going to arise from. So of course, that puts the question of interest rate hikes back front and center. And then the question is, how will central banks be able to raise interest rates? In the USA's case, they've got a very short duration on debt, so they've got a great deal of interest rate sensitivity for the government. But then the corporate sector, and most particularly the household sector, is less levered and then generally has fixed rate debt in mortgages. Whereas when we look at somewhere like Australia, well, the prospect of additional or tightening and potentially interest rate hikes, well, that's positive for banks, and the banking sector popped on the upside. And the fact that Canada has ended its quantitative easing program and may be raising rates next year, and potentially, well, they said in the middle quarters of the year, so perhaps let's just settle on June of next year. Well, then that's also helping to support the banking sector and financials there. But the bigger question is, how can they raise rates? Because lots of new mortgages in Canada are floating rate, even though the majority of existing mortgages are fixed rate. And then debt to GDP has risen considerably during the pandemic, and the public sector or the household sector has a debt to GDP ratio well in excess of 100%. Well, in Australia's case, it's almost 180%, even though the government has very low debt to GDP. So then the question is, how much can they really raise rates? And this is where the debt trap question comes in. Every country has got some sort of argument about the trade-offs that are going to come into play when they begin to raise rates. And obviously then, when we think about the stock market, there are going to be portions of the stock market will benefit, and we can see that with banks. They certainly benefit when interest rates begin to rise. And there will be others that are very liquidity dependent, will struggle. We're certainly not seeing any signs of struggle, however, in the largest companies. So when we look at the Fangman shares, that market cap of the eight largest companies, I've included Tesla in this measure, is now up to 11.5 trillion, and there's no sign of it stopping just yet, and it still has the sequence of higher reaction lows. And one thing that I think is interesting is when you do add Tesla into this group of shares, then you get a rather interesting chart here that it peaked back in May of last year, but then it's popped on the upside over the course of this week, and it's now right in the region of the peak from 2020. Of course, Tesla has had a really stunning performance, and we don't get quite as much back history when we include Tesla because the share only IPO'd in 2012. But it's certainly one of the largest companies right now, and it's certainly benefiting from access to lots of cheap liquidity. And this is a relative comparison to the market cap of the total NYSE. So though these eight companies now represent 21.8% of the total market cap of the index. So it's reasonable to assume that this bull market's not going to end until this chart rolls over. And there's no sign of it just yet, even though we have these pressures from inflation and these questions about just how much central banks can raise rates. Well, that is a recipe for an environment which will be liquidity fueled. And as long as interest rates remain low, well, then that's going to help to fuel speculative interest. So that's an additional reason why the Nasdaq in particular remains really quite firm, and it pushed on to another new high in here today. And we also know that when the yield curve spread eventually peaks and then trends lower, well, it's representative of tightening. But tightening and too tight are certainly worlds apart. So if we've now seen a lower high and again and then another lower high, so I guess I would consider this high from February to be a lower high because it is substantially below the peak values that we've seen during easing cycles of the past. And now we have another lower high that was put in at the beginning of this month. Well, there's the possibility then that this yield curve is going to continue to trend lower. And usually we see that stock markets do absolutely fine during these kinds of tightening events because the conclusion is that the tightening is necessary to blunt inflationary pressures and that it's not so tight as to arrest the potential for growth. And I suspect that that is a reasonable conclusion on this occasion as well. It's not until we see a sharp move higher in the short end of the curve and then a corresponding either stayed environment or contraction in yields at the long end of the curve, and that the short end exceeds the value on the long end, that we get an inverted yield curve, and then that starts to choke off liquidity. Well, that's a lead indicator for future problems. Well, that would suggest that we are now potentially at the bubble inflation stage. We've been in bubbly valuations for a while, and there is the potential that we could go for an even bigger bubble. I am also very aware of, and I think that there is at least some, it's credible, it's at least credible to start talking about fragile and robust assets. So Bitcoin falls very much into the liquidity-driven bull market basket, and then it's been pausing here around the 60,000 level. So far, this doesn't look like much more than a consolidation in the region of the previous peak. It would have to pull back by substantially more than it has done already in order to suggest that this is anything other than a pause. And That would also lend some support to the view that we are still in a benign environment for risk assets. Gold prices were marginally higher in here today, unable to hold the high today, whereas it didn't hold the low over the last 2 days. This, I think, falls into the robust asset basket. And obviously, then it should do well when people are worried about the fragile asset basket. And we're not at that particular point yet. I think, though, that gold will eventually pick up bids because people will start to hedge their bets against fragility. And I think that's where the bullish argument is likely to come from. And of course, also the potential that the dollar index isn't just pulling back in the short term, but we're not there yet. It hasn't yet been able to sustain a move below the trend mean. And as long as it's holding the move above the trend mean, well, then this is still an uptrend overall. But I'm still leery of being too bullish on the dollar. I think that there are too many challenges, and that the USA in particular is going to be slow to raise interest rates. And as interest rate differentials start to remanifest with other central banks raising rates, then that's likely to act as a headwind for the dollar overall, and it should act as a tailwind in particular for gold. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.